This is the Chester County Real Estate Podcast, bringing you the info you need to make your next move a great one.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Chester County Real Estate Podcast. This is the show that gives you the information that you need to make your next move a great one. I'm your host, Sean Dominski, and today I'm joined by Stephen Marks, an agent here at RE/MAX Ace Realty. And today we're going to go over some of the news and topics that are affecting Chester County residents, homeowners, buyers, and sellers. So, Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, from your perspective, first of all, what are you seeing happening?
So, yeah, I mean, there's kind of like that multi-offer mindset coming back for buyers. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because we kind of do have a shortage when it comes to inventory right now in the market. Mm-hmm. Now, that's probably our biggest challenge that we're kind of facing right now is definitely inventory. So as far as my buyers, I mean, the places that we do find and we do like, sometimes, you know, we get in there and there's not multiple offers, but it was kind of like that before. Yeah. And then sometimes we do get in this situation and there's, you know, five or six already in hand. So it really depends on, you know, a price point, location, everything else like that for the buyer standpoint. And then the biggest objection I'm getting right now from the seller standpoint is, where am I going to go?
Right.
So that's kind of like what I'm seeing right now is we're definitely seeing a lot of active buyers and people in the market. It's just trying to find them a place.
So one thing that I've heard and I've been seeing is that buyers have been more picky than they have been in the past. Have you experienced that? Or are they just as willing to throw any amount possible out at the sellers?
Mixed. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these people have been looking for that right home since we've had, you know, multiple offers 6 or 7 months ago.
Yeah.
Some of these people kind of thought that the market settled a little bit the way it is. And I mean, has it settled? Yes. You know, we're not seeing like some crazy stuff. I mean, I do know of one listing in Phoenixville mm-hmm. Recently that actually had 26 offers.
Wow.
And it was on the market for 2 days. But that's kind of like one of those outlier properties, you know, it kind of checked everybody's boxes. So everybody yeah. that was picky and like everything that they wanted, that was like the ideal house in Phoenixville. So I mean, as far as like pickiness and stuff like that coming back, I mean, people are, they want what they want, and that's like the best decision. Yeah, you know, that's the best way to say it.
Yeah.
Really. Like, I mean, again, too, I wouldn't want to buy a home that I don't want.
Right.
So they're going to be picky, and that's perfectly fine. But as far as pricing and trying to explain to them, I mean, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to get across. But I've realized after, you know, one or two missed opportunities on the perfect home for them, they kind of start to realize, hey, like, these are the things we have to do, and these are the steps we have to take.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, picky buyers have just been the way it's been ever since you know, 2008. So the idea that people were just going in there almost sight unseen, throwing offers, not doing inspections, stuff like that made me nervous. And it made a lot of agents and people who've been around for a while nervous because, it, you know, we're used to, like, this is a major investment. Mm-hmm. And when we were, you know, and when buyers were required to make decisions within, you know, hours that's going to affect them for the rest of their lives, It was tough. So I'm okay with a little bit of pickiness. I think the message is that you have these sellers looking at the days on market go up. So it's like, oh, it's been sitting for a week. It's been sitting for 2 weeks. Mm. You haven't gotten any offers. You know, what's wrong with it? And in reality, it's no, that's kind of the way it should be. Like yeah. houses, as much as sellers love it when a house just, you know, inundated with offers and it's off the market within 48 hours, that's great. But from a market standpoint, like, it's okay to take a little bit of time to have the buyers be able to fully understand what they're buying. So with that, so I do want to touch a little bit on today's mortgage rates. I know we're jumping around a little bit here. So just so everyone knows, I'm looking at mortgagenewsdaily.com to get the average interest rates from the banks. And today we're for a 30-year fixed rate. We're sitting at 6.55%. So I think over the course of the last couple months, that's actually not too bad. So it's a little bit of good news with interest rates. I feel like it's split. You know, people, I could talk to 100 people and 50 of them will say interest rates are going up in the spring and 50 of them will say interest rates are going down. So I try not to make any predictions.
It goes back to like the biggest saying that, like, I'm pretty sure every real estate agent said in their life is, we don't have a crystal ball.
Right.
Okay. We don't know, like, what's going to happen. We don't know what the Fed's going to do. We don't know what, you know, the best thing we can do is just really pay attention to those articles that do come out, you know.
So, yeah. And the other thing, too, is I take everything, I take everything anyone says with a grain of salt, and that includes the Fed. Mm-hmm. So here, I was looking on Realtor.com, and the other day, this was last week or so, Jerome Powell says here, he told Congress Tuesday that more aggressive interest rates might be needed to cool inflation. Now, mortgage interest rates are separate from the Fed's short-term rates, but they do follow each other. So after the comments, mortgage rates hit 7.03% for 30-year fixed-rate loans. And that's pretty high. You know, even if it's 0.03%, we're looking in the sevens. And when people see that, they're thinking like, oh, well, is it only a matter of time before it hits 8? So I think his comments kind of shocked the system a little bit, but then things settled down, you know. So now today's mortgage, that's why today's rates, since then, they've come down, and now we're at 6.55 as an average interest rate. Now, that also depends on a lot of other factors in the bank and that you're working with and stuff. This is just average across various banks. Here's a question. With the buyers that you're working with, are you seeing more conventional, or are you seeing more FHA? Because for a while, FHA kind of went to the wayside because it was more risk on the seller.
So, I mean, honestly, with the multiple offers, conventional is, of course, always stronger. Mm-hmm. I mean, cash is king, too. But, I mean, conventional is always stronger. But, no, I mean, I have been seeing a lot of FHA and PHFA loans getting used. Okay. Honestly, PHFA is probably hitting the market hardest.
Really?
Because, A, you can get a PHFA conventional loan, and you can still get all the government goods out of it and everything else like that. You know, but overall, like that's probably what I've seen the most is probably PHFA conventional.
Can you remind us real quick, refresh us on what PHFA is?
So
that's a state program, or?
Yeah, so PHFA is like, they still go through Fannie and Freddie,
okay.
But it's Pennsylvania Housing
Finance Authority.
Finance agency. And pretty much it's kind of like Pennsylvania's FHA loan to a sense. They help you give out government grants and get you into different programs to help you pay for down payment assistance. There's like KFIT and different things out there like that. So
and KFIT is
it's kind of like a program where the government helps you with down payment assistance.
Okay.
They give you money, then over time throughout living in the home, it actually pays off the loan. So in a sense, like through PHFA, you can almost get free money.
Right. Right.
As long as you plan on living in the house. Now, I mean, I'm not a loan expert as far as like when it comes towards like loan officers. But I mean, I do know some things about loans. So.
Yeah, I was just checking out PHFA.org. Looks like there's some great resources on there that it's worth checking out, including their Master Your Money podcast. Interesting. I remember them basically they had, you know, various down payment assistance programs, closing cost assistance programs. Now, it depends on what else is available. So, obviously, you need to talk to a loan officer, mortgage lender, banker, and they can kind of weigh out the different costs and benefits. But that's interesting that people are utilizing that. I was checking out some of the news here looking at some of the federal stuff that happened recently. Did you see this, the House passes remote online notarization legislation?
I heard about it. I'm not 100% sure exactly what NAR was stating when they put this article out, though.
So it's interesting because I don't remember this. I'm not that old, but I believe it was during the Clinton administration when Clinton basically said that a online signature, a virtual electronic signature, is as good as a written signature. So that's why we can have things like DocuSign, and you can take pictures of your checks and stuff like that. And legally, a virtual, electronic signature is supposed to equal a hard signature. Now, that doesn't mean every industry is going to accept it. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff with banks, and obviously, as you've probably seen, you need either a handwritten signature or even like a wet signature, mm-hmm. where it's like you actually have to sign that document. You can't make a copy of that document and forward it or something like that, or scan it or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been multiple times where like we're at settlement and the client's like, hey, I've seen this paper before. It's like, I sent you that kind of review a little bit ago, but we do need a wet signature on it.
Yes.
Just because like certain banks don't allow DocuSign and stuff like that. So.
Exactly. And for as long as, you know, up until, yeah, I mean, for as long as I can remember, at closing, you always had to do it pretty much in person. So even during the lockdown, you had a notary of some sort, you know, like whether it's a title agent, closing agent, coming and having you sign those documents for the closing of your house. It wasn't something you could do online. You could sign the listing agreement, you could sign the seller's disclosure, you couldn't sign the actual documents without a notary. So what it looks like is here, the Secure Notarization Act would provide meaningful relief to America's homeowners and prospective buyers by allowing immediate nationwide use of remote online notarization technology. So basically, and I don't know exactly how this looks like, but what I imagine it would look like, you could get on a Zoom call with a notary and get something notarized. Mm-hmm. So we could have remote virtual settlements.
Yeah. See, that would have helped me out today.
Yeah. My question is, do we want that? Like, it would obviously be a little nice. Like, if you have clients who are closing and it's on the other side of Pennsylvania, which you're licensed for, and you know, they found a place that they wanted and you were able to help them through the process, but you don't want to drive 4 hours to Penn State to help them close, or to Raystown Lake to help them close on their vacation home. You know, could if we get on a Zoom call where it's you, the buyers, the sellers, the mortgage lender, the title, the notary or title agent, all right there on the Zoom call? It's convenient, but is it necessarily better? What do you think?
I mean, it's kind of like a 50-50 split.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, it would be nice to the aspect of, hey, sometimes it's kind of hard, like, to get a notary out there. I mean, a lot of the times at settlement, I mean, I've only ever really experienced, like, having to have an actual notary there. And, like when it comes towards, like, mobile home transfers and stuff like that, I mean, well, everything else kind of gets handled by the closer, which, I mean...
Well, the closing agent or the title agent will be a notary.
Yeah.
Like, we'll have their notary license, and they'll probably be like signing the book. It's just you're more concerned about the checks and the big stack of documents.
Yeah. So the big thing is if you're going to go with like a law office,
okay? Yeah.
And you're settling with a law office, and let's say they don't have an in-house notary. Something like that would come in super handy, because then you can just Zoom the person. I know like the one transaction I did, we kind of had to go that route because it was a law office, and the notary, she was awesome, but she was like running around all day. She had like 40 billion things to do. So I feel like for her job wise, this will make it so much easier.
Yeah.
She's not spending $100 a day on gas. She's not, you know, driving 50 different places. So that aspect it will, but it's almost like, can it necessarily be 100% secure?
Well, and
that's the only scarce behind that. Like, how easy is it to fake somebody on a Zoom call? Like, that's, I mean, I don't think people would really do it, but like, you're seeing a lot of these videos coming out.
You would
out.
Hope not, right? Yeah, the deep fakes and stuff.
Yeah, the deep fakes and stuff like that. You're seeing a lot of those things come out, and they're like, this looks real.
Yeah.
So how easy is it for somebody to do something like that live on Zoom and, you know, fake being a notary or fake being a seller?
I think it'd be great for like refis, stuff like that. Because like, when you refinance on your house, you're going to have to sit down with a notary. You know, usually, in my experience, they've come to the house and signed the documents. But it might be nice to just be able to do that electronically and have more flexibility in scheduling and stuff like that. However, the other thing too is like, I feel like a good title company is pretty important. Mm-hmm. And I always appreciate having the closing agent, the title person, whoever is doing it, there and able to explain things. I know a lot of agents like explaining things as well. Personally, I like having them. I just feel like it's another voice that like can, especially if they're good at it.
Yeah.
And I like, you know, if the buyer has a question or the seller has a question, I like having someone there that can answer it, that can like kind of walk them through it, point at things. So I see a lot of value in that. Now, 10, 15 years from now, am I going to sound like a like a dodo bird, where it's like back in my, like I like having a piece of paper and someone sit in front of you. It's like, come on, man, we don't do that anymore. Maybe, but I'm not quite ready to give up that closing agent and the service that they provide.
I mean, coming from somebody that's all for technology and, you know, doing stuff like that, I mean, I do agree with you in a sense, though. Like, when you show up on settlement day, it's kind of like, okay, like, this is a big day. Like,
right.
You want to make sure you can comfort your clients. You want to make sure you're kind of there for them, because you're still, like, the idea of being an agent is you have their back, you know? Like, you have their best interest in your mind. So, like, you're almost, like, there in a sense to help them, you know, guide them through the process. And, I mean, doing it over Zoom, like, yeah, you can do that. But you're also on a Zoom call with four other people. It's kind of like you almost take away like the privacy,
right,
of some of it. So, I mean, it's kind of hit or miss. I feel like, I mean, like, yes, it would come in handy if, like, the vacation home aspect, or, like, say you're double licensed, you know, here and in Florida or something like that. You know, like, that would definitely come in handy. But it's almost how far will I take it, I think, is the big question.
Exactly, yeah. And the other thing, too, is just, I would hope that home buyers are just working, like, they know who they're working with, and the mortgage, the lender, the agent, the title company, the people that they're choosing, that they're, you know, they're willing to look in to see what they offer. You know, I hope it's a selling point. Like, hey, I will be there with you at closing. I will make sure we will have a title closing agent, you know, and there will be people that you can talk to. Not going to just leave you hanging on a Zoom call. Now, on the other hand, I am glad that the legislation is going through to allow it. I just hope that the industry kind of is very hesitant to adopt it unless absolutely necessary.
I hope they use it responsibly. It's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
I have a feeling they're going to jump, you know, feet first into it and take it running, but hopefully they, you know, take it slow and easy, and we're able to kind of, you know, ease into it a
little bit. Gotcha.
Because it's a big change. A lot of the people, like, that are in the room, they've been doing it for 30 years, you know? So for them to adopt it overnight, it's going to be kind of different.
Yeah, absolutely. So on that topic of buyers, let's shift over to first-time home buyers. I love working with first-time home buyers because of the, you know, just helping people take that next step in life. However, I saw this article here on PAREALTORS.org. So this is the Pennsylvania Association of Realtors. And they posted that according to Rocket Homes, 57% of buyers looking for their first home want it to be their forever home. Be their forever home. As the average age of the first-time home buyer continues to grow older, reaching an all-time high of 36, first-time buyers aren't looking to move again in a few years. Says for the 43% of first-time home buyers who said they were looking for a starter home, affordability was the top reason they aren't planning to buy their forever home now. So I kind of want to bring this up and just see what your thoughts are on the starter home idea. I personally go back and forth on it, because I remember being not 36. I was a little bit younger when I bought my first house, but I wanted it to be my, like, I didn't want this. Like, I feel like no one goes into their search saying, I just need a starter home. However, once they start looking realistically at what it looks like, it becomes a reality. I don't know. What are your thoughts? And have you seen any, like, shifting in opinions on that?
I mean, I look at it both ways personally. So I grew up with, you know, my dad and, you know, family and friends kind of like putting in my head that it's like, hey, you buy your first house, you buy something that needs a little bit of work, you fix it up 5 years down the road. You know, do a cash out refinance, or you take a HELOC out on the property and you go buy your forever home with that money and use the first one as an investment property.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the aspect of, like, you know, almost house hacking in a sense. That's kind of like what I grew up around. But then I also do understand that, you know, real estate investing is not for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody wants to house hack, and some people just prefer, if they can afford it right away, to be comfortable in their situation. So I do understand, you know, them going out and finding their forever home, because it is a stressful process.
Yeah.
It is something that some people only want to do once in their lifetime. So I can see that.
Yeah. I'll bring it back to my personal experience, because that's the one I'm most familiar with. And I remember when I was buying my first house, I was seeing homes. Like, I had friends who were buying, let's say, like, two-bedroom condos that were in apartment building, like an apartment-style condo. I was also seeing there's a – around here, there's some older townhomes. You can get, like, two-, three-bedroom townhomes. And the ones that kind of concerned me were the ones that didn't have a basement. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how familiar you are with some of these older communities. I remember Village Walk was one.
Yep.
And I don't want to trash any communities. It's a great place. I'd love to have an investment property in Village Walk, honestly.
If I could speak, my family has one in there, and we absolutely love the community.
Really? So, like, you have an investment? Oh, okay. Anyway, so that's so funny, because I legitimately thought, like, man, that'd be a great place to have an investment property. But I remember when I was looking to buy my first house, didn't have kids, and I knew that a two-bedroom house with no basement would not, like, I would have to move in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. At some point, I would have to move. And that was something where I was like, and I think it was because I still had a little bit of, I don't want to say trauma, but memory of 2008. So I also had friends who bought really nice places and then lost half their equity within a matter of days, weeks, months, whatever. And that was really scary too. And if they had, you know, and then there was a lot of people who got stuck in their house. And that was another thing in 2008 that when you saw the market really shift in 2016 is what you like kind of didn't realize is like people got stuck in their houses for a lot longer than they planned. So when I bought my first house, I can relate to the sentiment. I want my next home to be my forever home because I was afraid of getting stuck in the house. That sounds kind of funny, but it was like kind of off-putting, but it's like, I didn't want to get a house that if I did get stuck in, it would be detrimental. Mm-hmm. There's some condo complexes. I don't want anyone to feel like I'm knocking their neighborhood or anything, but they were just so small that I was like, this would be good. I could rent this, but I don't think I could stay here for longer than 5, 6 years or so.
Well, that's kind of like, honestly, like that was like kind of put in my head.
Yeah.
You know, cause like growing up, I mean, like we completely renovated our Village Walk place, and my dad's kind of see that, you know, he bought that place back in the, I want to say, late 80s.
Did he buy it? Did he live there?
Yeah, he lived there for probably about, I think, a year and a half, 2 years.
Okay.
And then he, you know, went out and ended up buying another property. So, but I understand everybody's finances are different. Not everything kind of like lines up sometimes like that. And, you know, markets have changed. But I mean, it's really just remembering that like real estate is a long-term hold game too. So, yeah. Like when you do buy, like with the mindset of I'm only gonna live here for 5, 6 years, in reality you're looking at it, I'm gonna buy this property and then 5, 6 years from now I'm gonna reassess where my situation's at.
Yeah.
Because there's no way to like tell where the market's gonna be in 5 years. You know, so you know, buying back in 2008, yeah, that was definitely probably a scary time to see 50% of your hard earned money go to, you know,
yeah,
go kaput. But again, too, look at those property like values now.
Yeah.
To people that were able to actually, you know, hold on to the property.
And I say it becomes like a realistic, I don't want to say unfortunate, but it becomes a reality when you actually look at the numbers. Mm. So when, I don't know about you, but I know myself, when I was a first-time home buyers, they're looking at all the numbers and they're like, hey, cheap-looking houses in Chester County are $300 to $350. I'm looking in the $300 to $350 range without actually understanding what the payments look like with taxes and HOAs, PMI, stuff like that. And then when you actually look at what the payments are and you know what you're making on your $12-$15 an hour job, yeah, and you're like, you're more in like the $180 to $200 range. Which even then you're still looking at like $1,600-$1,800 a month, I believe, depending on, you know, yep, the area and stuff. And you're like, wait, but there's nothing of it. Like that's, there's nothing available for that. And you're like, yeah, it's tough. And it's, I feel like things are more expensive once you actually look at the actual hard numbers. But when you have that starter home, if you can build up some equity, you're going to be able to use that equity to get, you know, to move up in life. Whereas you're constantly just waiting for that forever home, it's going to be hard because you're not taking it step by step. You're just trying to hold out to you can make a huge leap. And now you're looking at like a $4,000 a month payment, which is a huge payment. However, if you had a starter home for 10 years and you were able to use some of that equity, that payment might only be $2,500 because you were able to use the equity from your starter home, put it towards your next house. And that's how I think previous, you know, the last two or three generations were able to eventually kind of make their way up into the middle class instead of just jumping right in.
I think you almost have to look at your housing purchase as a business.
Okay.
Your down payments are your initial startup cost, and then your monthly payment is your overhead. So how can you get your overhead so it's almost a zero? Okay, so that's the idea that I've always kind of looked at it, is like, hey, you know, I got to start small and you can grow big. Start small, go out and get yourself that $180,000, $200,000 condo, live in there for a couple of years, and then realize, hey, I can get $1,300, $1,400 a month for this place. I refinance, my mortgage is only $1,000. I'm walking away with $400 in positive equity. You know, so how can I take that $1,400 a month payment that I was making? Well, now I have an extra $400. You know, so kind of just reinvest in yourself at that point.
Yeah, I think it was Dave Ramsey who said this, and I don't recommend everything he says, but he makes some really solid points where it's kind of like you move out of your parents' house and you kind of in your head are expecting in your early 20s the lifestyle that your parents are enjoying in their like 50s, and because you weren't really there as your parents lived, you know, most people, they didn't experience like the living in Village Walk and then fixing it up and all the renovations and the starter homes and the thing. They know the nice neighborhood with the single family home and so they move out and they're like, well, this is what I grew up in. This is what I should be able to do. And it doesn't quite work that way. I think Dave Ramsey was also talking about cars. So like, you know, you get your first job and you just go out and you just lease like a beautiful, like a nice car. And you're kind of like, you know, hey, you know, your parents had to work to get to that point. And it took some time. Hopefully it doesn't take as much time for you. You know, you always, hopefully that the future generations do better. But in a lot of cases, it is a reality. I think one thing that helped me is, did you ever read Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
Yes. I was literally about to talk about that book. I think Robert Kiyosaki. He had a great diagram in that book on between assets and liabilities and how to draw the line between the two. So that's kind of like where I get a lot of my mindset from too, is how can we make this housing payment instead of making it a liability, something we have to pay every month, how do we make that almost an appreciating asset?
Yeah, and I would say from my standpoint, just viewing your house as a liability and not an asset just led me to like, hey, let's spend as little as possible on housing, for something we could comfortably live in. So my first, when I had that conversation with my wife when we bought our first house, what really helped was we basically said, hey, let's not look for something that we want to, let's stop looking for our forever home. Let's stop looking for that. Like, let's look at something that we could rent. What's basically the most affordable thing that would be good enough for us to rent, and just kind of shift our perspectives to like, what's our renting standards? Let's apply that to our housing standards. We also had a little bit of incentive, so I don't want to give away too much of my age here, but Obama was writing checks to first-time homebuyers at the time. I don't know if you remember that or heard about that, but basically there was all this criteria. So we got an $8,000 tax credit for buying a house that year. So that helped too. And I was like, hey, let's just take advantage of this program and just buy the cheapest thing that we would rent if it was an option. And we were fine. You know, I joke about that first house and the neighborhood that I was in, but honestly, it was a great place. It was a great place to live. And we had our first two kids there, and having little toddlers running around, it did the job. So, so we appreciate that. So I don't want to take up too much time. We can start to wrap it up. Obviously, there was a lot of stuff going on with I don't want to say crisis. I don't want to say banking crisis, because this isn't 2008, which directly affected the housing industry. But we got SVB, we got Signature Bank, and there's another bank, starts with an S, and so we're starting to see some activity in the banking sector, and I don't really want to talk too much about it because I don't think we've really seen the full extent of what this kind of ends up affecting.
Yeah, and I mean, I think all that kind of just had a big snowball effect. And I have seen some articles, I don't want to quote anything because I don't know exactly, but some articles that the government is trying to put in a pause to this right away, and the people from SVB, like, the government's kind of helping take care of it, so it's not going to be coming out of taxpayer money. And that they're, these banks kind of pay into a special program when they are FDIC insured. So anybody that had like over the $250,000 that was insured, they should be able to get all that back. What I've been reading.
I mean, yes, I just, and I've seen them say that. It's like, let's see what happens, because obviously the FDIC, whatever program this is, doesn't have enough cash on hand to cover every single account that's FDIC insured. Like, there's no way for all of America who has an account with under $250,000 in it, there's a dollar-to-dollar match. You know, so there is a point where the FDIC insurance program would have to would run out of money, I think. So I don't want to say too much because I feel like, you know, if someone's an economist and they're like freaking out right now, please correct me. But it's just like, I'm looking at like the realities of it, and I was like, okay, how can all of our, like, oh, if you have under $250,000, you're good. It's like, but how, like, the government is in debt. You're telling me they have $1 trillion or whatever just sitting around in FDIC insurance, which would be great, I guess. So anyway, I think we need to kind of wait and see where it goes. I was talking to someone earlier today. He's like, honestly, the market, like, the interest rates are dropping a little bit, as we saw. So right now, we're not seeing any negative effects on the housing industry. My thing is that I think there's going to be domino effects. I think it's going to affect housing. I don't think it's going to directly. I don't think it'll be. If it affects housing, it's not going to be direct. So some other things will happen that will be affected by it that will eventually affect mortgage and housing and stuff, possibly. But right now, it's just a matter of watching the market and see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. So it's trying to figure out exactly what is going to happen, because we're still, like you were saying, we're still in the beginning of whatever is going on. So hopefully we can catch it early and catch it fast, so we don't really see too much of whatever's going to happen in the economy. But again, the world may never know.
So. All right. Well, with that, I think we can wrap it up. I will say there are a couple interesting articles I'll probably post to the website with ChesterCountyPodcast.com or the Facebook page. One is 9 Suburban Towns Pushing the Boundaries of the Philadelphia Region. That was in PhillyMag.com. What was cool about that, we got a little bit of a shout out in Chester County. We had Salisburyville, Oxford, Elverson. It's kind of cool just seeing like a little bit of a, I don't know, some of these smaller towns get mentioned. Now, whether the context, you know, I'd love to hear people's comments, but now whether the context is a good thing or not, because basically what we're seeing is previously rural areas become more suburban. And I feel like people have feelings around that. And the other thing too, I found this interesting article: 4 tasks that homeowners, veteran homeowners, know you got to do in March. So I'll post those to Facebook and on the website. But just kind of giving some people some timely advice on what they need to start thinking as we head into spring for homeowners. Anything else? Anything else to add or any thoughts?
Nothing I can think of right now.
All right. Well, hey, guys, if you have any questions or comments or something you want to add, feel free to contact us. Head over to our website, ChesterCountyPodcast.com. There's a contact form. I'll check that personally. So, and I'll make sure if you have any comments for Steven, he'll get them as well. I want to thank you for joining us. Also, check us out on Facebook. We're also on YouTube and anywhere podcasts are found. Steven, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
So best way to get in touch with me is probably by phone. Either give me a call or shoot me a text at 404-883-0928.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks everyone. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Chester County Real Estate Podcast, brought to you by RE/MAX Ace Realty. serving buyers and sellers in the Chester County area. Subscribe for new episodes at acerealtypa.com/podcast. And you can find us on Facebook, YouTube, and wherever podcasts are found.